Good morning, Lynn.
All right, I hear you twice because I got you. You're so nice. There we go.
The echo.
Joni, happy birthday, honey. I know it's not your birthday yet, but thank you so much, Joan Williams, for your amazing, amazing, amazing teaching. And so, yeah, I have Bruce Rawls on the phone right now. So, good morning, Bruce, and how are you doing this morning?
I'm good. And yourself?
I'm great. Oh, it's foggy here. I got up this morning. I looked out. It's foggy. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Look at that weather.
I haven't even peeked outside yet.
So. You know how it is. So I'm going to put on my headphones so I can hear you a little better.
Sure.
Let's see here. Here we go. I like that better. All right. So you had sent out a message and said, let's talk about what? And now I'm looking for it right now. So maybe you remember what it is.
Well, you know, I forgot what I sent you, but at the time it seemed interesting. But you know what? I was just going through today's workbook lesson, and I was thinking that reminded me of the not know principle that Ken Wapnick talks about. And I thought, well, that could be a good topic, you know, because it's really, you know, what we're studying is really an unsteady. It's a course in an undoing. All the things, all the barriers that we've placed in front of the awareness of love's presence. that is such a pervasive thing. And I think this workbook lesson 44, which we're recording this on February 13th of 2016, this workbook lesson number 44 for people who do them chronologically, which I've been doing a couple years in a row now, is a great example of how we can look at our resistance and not condemn ourselves. There's also another workbook lesson where, as Ken points out, you know, the beloved author, which ultimately is us, the part that we've taken with us into the dream to remember that the stuff we made up is just a tiny mad idea, reminds us that, you know, our resistance is just a way of putting off the peace that we're all looking for. And because of just an unconscious, unfounded idea that somehow we've messed up perfect oneness, we've thrown God under the bus, whatever metaphor you like, and you know, we somehow did something that's unforgivable. And in fact, I was sitting around last night with a couple of other friends who happen to be course students, and we've been doing this kind of a sort of a quasi men's night every other week. Mostly it's just kind of miscellaneous chit chat, but you know, we do end up talking about the course a bit, but
is that for quasi men or is that for
quasi discussion group? You know, in other words, we don't stick to just, you know, course topics and reading from the course. But we just, you know, so a quick aside, I'm going to post a short video of one of the guys is named Jerry, and his last name starts with S. And then yesterday I was thinking, well, Jerry Seinfeld has this new online show called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, right? Have you heard of that one?
Yeah, I have heard of that one. I was just coughing.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Oh, sure. Anyway, they're fun. I'm gonna have to go back and watch the rest of them that I haven't seen right now, but or you know after we're done. But anyway, I was thinking, gee, I could do a you know, why should Jerry Seinfeld have the fun? I'm gonna, and we've been driving out to get takeout. So I'm gonna do an episode with a short video that I took with my phone of course students in cars getting Chinese takeout with Jerry S.
I love it. That's hilarious.
Brought to you by instead of by ACURA, it's going to be brought to you by ACIM blog. So anyway, it'll be fun and silly, but the whole point is it is silly. I mean, the stuff we made up, you know, our parody, which in this using this parody as an example of another parody, A more, you know, well-known one is it's just a silly, forgivable parody on the reality that we are. So I was thinking that, you know, if we could read lesson 44 this morning, is that work for you?
I love that idea. And actually, this is really great because this has actually been a huge practice for me lately. And oh my gosh, I'm just really surprised. Although I now that I look at it, I know I shouldn't be surprised at how many times I attempt to make myself guilty for things. And I see myself as the culprit in so many situations. And it's really been brought to my attention a lot recently because I've been looking at my interactions with my kids, my granddaughter, my daughter, how, you know, it even though I don't intend to be meddling or be, you know, interfering or trying to boss people around or tell people what to do, I'm noticing that I do a lot. And it's always because of a sense of guilt that I feel for not fixing them, not making them perfect, not, you know, giving them, especially my kids. I'm just looking at all the shades of guilt that are just, it's everything. And it's tiny little things, but every single bit of it is the product of a guilty thought. And once I started realizing how much I shame myself, I guilt myself, I point out my own faults to myself and make myself bad. It's no wonder that, you know, I feel bad. It's no wonder that I distrust myself. And it's no wonder that I'm not seeing in the light because I am actually looking and working with darkness when I'm doing that. I'm just, it's all based on guilt. It never really hit me. And a lot of times people will tell you, well, it's about guilt, but I don't feel guilty about anything. And I felt that way myself for a long time until I started really looking at the motivation behind the things that I was doing. You know, it wouldn't, because I would say, oh, I'm just trying to be good, but really I'm just trying to make up for a mistake. I'm really just trying to fix things because I broke them. You know, this is what my mind is going through and showing me. My ego is telling me, yeah, you're the one at fault and you have to be the one who fixes it. And once I realized that, you know, I couldn't.
Good luck with that, right?
Really. Once I realized that not only couldn't I not fix it, but guess what? Nothing really went wrong. Mm-hmm. All of these things are my thoughts about what appears to be happening. And yes. I'm the one who is giving it all the meaning that it has. Boy, where did I hear that before?
Beautifully stated, Lynn. Wow, you just said a lot right there. And I was thinking, you know, that's the ego's curriculum is really 50 Shades of Guilt, right? That's its gripping novella that we're the stars of. And we've so identified with this sort of, you know, trashy soap opera that we've forgotten that there's another way of looking at things rather than as from the perspective of, you know, this victimized character that we see on the screen of our mind that, you know, we've so identified with that we think we're that character, you know, and forgetting that we're, you know, actors or more importantly, we're the screenwriter sitting in the audience, you know, laughing hysterically with our inner kindness teacher, aka Jesus of the Course, Holy Spirit, you know, whatever metaphor you like. And it's just silly because we don't look at the guilt, but as long as we don't look at it, it remains untouched and unexamined. And I was thinking as you were sharing just now, were you attending the academy class that the Foundation for A Course in Miracles put out last weekend, last Sunday and Monday?
No, I wasn't. No,
because you were summarizing and paraphrasing wonderfully. One of the key ideas that they shared and went into in depth, which I'm going to have to listen to again because I was multitasking due to my prayer commitments that day. You know, I was listening to it while I was doing other things, basically. And the replays should be available in the next few days. But these academy classes are wonderful, by the way. If you haven't had a chance to attend one in person, you can attend them live via streaming and then watch and listen to the replays. But anyway, the gist of what this latest one was, titled The Past Is Over, It Can Touch Me Not, was if we can look at the contents of our mind without condemnation and just see the depth of with which ego has permeated our self-concept. And like you say, just watching your interactions with your family and friends and your responses to stuff you see on TV or reading the newspaper or in traffic or, you know, in public, you know, or private, you know, just look at all the things that go through your mind as you go through a typical day. And without, you know, recoiling in terror, which is the usual response, but just noticing it without any kind of condemnation. And that takes a lot of practice to just notice without, you know, fleeing and you know, quickly retreating from it. And I think it fits perfectly with this lesson is we have to be willing to confront the resistance and chip away at it a little at a time, because we're not going to do it all at once. No, you know, I don't think the course in any sense of the word advocates that. But what it does advocate is a consistent, disciplined approach to mind training where we slowly but surely start to look at the desolation of the ego. And it's like not just draining a swamp, it's like draining an oceanic swamp where the little islands that we think are wonderful, the little special love havens, when we get to them, we discover they're desert.
Yep.
Maybe a dead palm tree or two, but you know, it's basically a desert island when we get close up to see them firsthand. So then in our myopic vision, we see another island off in the distance. Oh, that must be paradise, you know? So we set sail for that. Well, we're slowly but surely draining this oceanic swamp. And eventually, we realize that the whole planet is desolate, you know, and to use that metaphor. But we don't do that unless we look at, with our inner kindness teacher, with Holy Spirit, with the Jesus of the Course, and see that from that perspective, above the ego's battleground of duality, that we can afford to look at it without condemnation, without judgment, without criticism and censure, and just say, oh, that is a silly choice.
Yes.
And that was what we were talking about last night. I think I started to go down that the conversation that we had last night was when we got to talking about backpacking. That reminded me how when I was in the Sierras, about 30 years ago, and first started carrying A Course in Miracles around with me in the early editions, I had a paperback version, one of the early ones, and it finally just fell apart because I, you know, was flipping through it and underlining and carrying it around, and especially in the backpack up in the stairs. Anyway, but one of the first things I remember reading that was so comforting was the idea that error and sin are different. That error can be undone just in the same way that you can, when you find yourself driving into a cul-de-sac and realize that wasn't where you were trying to get to, instead of, you know, trying every single angle, but turning around, doing a 180 and going out the way you came in, and that's what the ego does. It says, well, there must be a way out of this mess, but within the mess. No, we have to actually back out, and that's what the undo process of forgiveness is. It's the undoing that gets us out of the cul-de-sac, does a 180, puts it in reverse, and gets back on the thoroughfare. And I think we do that by looking at our resistance, seeing that it's not getting us anywhere, and noticing that there is a peace beyond that we can allow ourselves to have little glimpses of.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be all at once, but we can give ourselves a little bit of peace.
Well,
now and then. And that's not too scary.
Well, yeah, exactly. But here's the deal is you cannot do this yourself. And here's, we get into trouble because we get, you know, we look and say, oh, you know, there's, you know, I think I can, you know, I can handle that, or I can cope with that, or you know, that's not such a big deal. And, you know, but really, honestly, none of it, not even the tiniest little bit of it, can you undo yourself. And that's a huge mistake that people make. I've made it over and over and over and over again. Because, you know, my ego seems to think that it knows how to do it. And really, the only way you can do it is just what this lesson is saying. So I'm going to read the first paragraph of this lesson, and let's talk about it. So this is lesson 44. God is the light in which I see. Today, we are continuing the idea for yesterday, adding another dimension to it. You cannot see in darkness, and you cannot make light. You can make darkness and then think you see in it, but light reflects life and is therefore an aspect of creation. Creation and darkness cannot coexist, but light and life must go together, being but different aspects of creation. So the light is this mind. And this is my interpretation of this. It could be something different entirely. But to me, the light is this mind that is capable of looking at the darkness and seeing that it what it is. It is capable of shining a light on the darkness so that I can see without being afraid. And, you know, once you go into any dark situation where you're nervous and afraid because you can't see, and you turn on the light and you can see, even if you turn on the light for just an instant, and I know, I'm sure you've experienced this too, like you're going to go into a room and, you know, someone's sleeping in the room, and you want to find something in the room, don't know exactly where it is, and you don't want to wake the person up, so you flick the light on just real quick and look and flick it right off. Have you ever done that?
And that's usually when you see the cockroaches scurrying rapidly, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, let's forget about that part. but
metaphorically, anyway.
But yeah, you flick the light and you see and you scope and scan, and then, you know, maybe the light, you flick the light back off. You still remember where things were, and that's how I get around a lot, is you remember where things were, and so you can go to them. Excuse me. And so even for a moment, for that mind to be able to shine the light into this darkness, to even have an idea that there's something there, that there's nothing there, there's something there that's not what I'm seeing, then gives me the courage to move on and keep doing this. But I can't do it myself because I don't own the light. God is the light. And so I've got to let God, metaphorically, of course, God isn't caring about light or dark or any of these things. Metaphorically, I've got to let God do this, not me.
Yep. Yeah, and just as a side note, you know, the Course, like Ken Wapnick says, Jesus is very loose with language in the Course, and sometimes he'll use God, which obviously is mixing the level one and level two language of you know, like you pointed out very appropriately, that, you know, that how could perfect oneness, and that was one of the concepts I think it was very helpful for me to finally get, you know, how could perfect oneness have anything to do with duality? And so in that awareness, that perfect awareness that includes everyone and everything, not in the way that we think of it, but, you know, in truth, that awareness has no cognizance, that has no respect or acknowledgement of anything less than that. And anything less than that is metaphorically the darkness. So anything involving space, time, individuality, separate interests, people, bodies, you know, personas, all that stuff. You know, galaxies, quasars, black holes, gravitational waves. We can cover a lot of turf here. You know, any of that stuff.
Perception.
The whole realm of perception, yeah. And I, a couple of moments ago, I'm sort of rambling again, but I was thinking what you just said reminded me of, I think, a really pivotal idea in the first part of chapter 21, I believe it is, where the one that has the forgotten song, the intro to that has a phrase that I found really helpful, and it is, your cues for inference are wrong. And then it talks about how we stumble around in the dark, you know, and like you say, you flick on the light briefly and you think, well, I think I remember where that was. But in our case, that flickering of the light was so long ago, and we've gotten so far down the rabbit hole and deep into the labyrinthine cave of our mind that we're basically clueless here, you know, certainly on our own. And the on our own is trying to do without that vision that we took with us into the battleground, into the world of duality, that helps us use the very things that we made to distract us and to divert us and to deceive us, which is anything, again, having to do with space or time or individuality, and certainly guilt, and looking at those things and saying, oh, that is just an isolated perspective, and it's not the big picture. Actually, Greg Braden, who's a friend that we went to Egypt with years ago, a couple of decades plus now, had a nice perspective on this. And I think he was kind of, you know, resonating with the idea that Ken Wapnick has. This is not sinful, evil, or wicked. It's just silly. And he was saying that, if I can remember Greg's words about looking at it, he was talking about basically, you know, the mental process of looking at the mind, and instead of calling it wrong, just looking at it as ineffective. I'm probably paraphrasing that greatly, but there was something he said a few years back that I thought was really, really helpful. But it was basically just, you know, again, looking without condemnation, looking at the mind's, you know, traffic and chatter and noise, and seeing all that as a stream of data, so to speak, kind of like the physics announcement this past week of, you know, looking at this waveform and just seeing, oh, there's nothing there. And in this case, symbolically, it was, you know, the duality of two black holes, you know, massive you know, vacuums of stuff. You know, what a great metaphor for the undoing, huh?
Oh gosh, no kidding. No kidding.
And you know, the duality collapsing in on itself. Actually, let me see if I can find it. I actually found a quote from Stephen Colbert that I used in my second book that I thought was really hilarious. Anyway, he was talking about the weight of the ego. I'll paraphrase that one too, because I remember he said something on his not his current show, but his past one a few years ago that I thought was funny. It's something like the weight of the ego is so great that it collapses in on itself like a black hole, you know, something like that.
That's really true.
I'm paraphrasing.
And it's that's so funny, it's so nothing.
Yeah. But we have to look at the nothing. We have to be willing to see the nothingness and the futility of our approach. And watch our little system, and yet another great Ken audios/books, you know, From Futility to Happiness is one of my favorites, because it talks about the myth of Sisyphus and, you know, pushing the boulder up the hill over and over again. You know, it's in the shape of the head of Zeus, you know, that just to, you know, add insult to injury. The self-made god in the pantheon of multiple gods in the Greek mythology, who basically was upset with Sisyphus for pointing out his flaws, and so he condemned him to push this huge replica of his head up the mountain over and over again. That's part of the story that sometimes is forgotten. Is that he was actually, you know, a stone that looked like Zeus's head. He had to push up the hill over and over again for eternity, supposedly. But yeah, that's you know, the light that we see is really the light that says, I can afford to. I'm doing my everyday stuff, well, you know, my Groundhog Day routine, my Sisyphus boulder pushing and slogging through, you know, back and forth from the fishing boats, as Jonathan Seagull might say, you know, looking at those everyday things and seeing how we invest in it, an identity connection to darkness, with unless we examine it. And that, again, was what the emphasis of this academy class was just looking without judgment at the depth of which we've invested in self-condemnation and that inner critical talk about everything and everyone. And instead of running away in terror, just saying, oh, yeah, there's that ego chatter again. Yep. And I'm not that.
And I'm not that. And not only am I not that, but it's just a silly, like you said, a silly thing. I'm not guilty for any of it. That's the thing that I think I'm really starting to look at, obviously, because that's where I am in my path right now, is looking at all the sources of guilt in my mind and all the ways that I condemn myself and, you know, keep pushing that, that head of Zeus up the mountain every day. The reason is because I can't believe that I am what God created. I can't believe what he's telling me I am here in this course. You know, all the things that he says about us. You know, you're like a star shining, you know, in the heavens so far away, so beautiful. You know, all the things that he says about us that we just flat do not believe. We think, oh, that's really pretty and nice. Wouldn't that be nice if it was true? But that's really what we are. And so what is it that's preventing me from seeing that about myself? My own self-worth is being, and no wonder then I can't accept the gifts of God, because I don't believe I deserve them. And if I don't believe I deserve salvation, then I'm not going to look for it or expect it. Or I'm not going to try to do anything to get it. I'm going to think that maybe in another lifetime or lifetimes away from now, or somehow or the other, I'm going to be so worthy that I'm going to deserve it, but not right now. These are the mistakes that we make about ourselves over and over and over again, because we accept the belief in guilt. And right. So it's this, and Jesus tells us guilt is the fabric of the illusion. The entire illusion is made of guilt.
Yes,
and so if you
yes.
look at the guilt behind every object, everything, every body part, everything, it's all you're seeing it all because of this belief that something has gone wrong. I could go into detail about that, but it would take a long time. but the fact is that unless we look at that guilt, and unless we actually see the reason that it is not true. That's why Diedrich Walsack and the Choose Again is so good, because it really goes into why do you believe that that's true about you? And when you look at the reality of it, you see it couldn't possibly be that you are this hideous creature that you think you are. And, you know, I mean, Jesus tells us that over and over, but how many times have I just stopped and said, you know, I mean, I said, yeah, you're right. I believe I'm a hideous creature, and you think I'm real good. You think I'm light and joy and peace and all that stuff. Well,
right.
No, you know, I'm basically telling him he's wrong. Mm-hmm. You may be right about all these other people, but you're not right about me, and I'm special and different.
Right. Yeah.
And anyway. Go on.
Yeah, you raised a really important point, and one of the other workbook lessons, you know, starts out with, you know that's actually you think it's going to be this really wonderful flowery light joy peace kind of thing, and it starts off, you know, you think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin, and like, you know, one of my favorite and humorous, and I think the humor is important, because if we can laugh at our investment in our egos, that can be really helpful in undoing it. And anyway, one of the humorous comments that Ken made in one of his talks was, probably not many course students would take a little placard that says, "Welcome to the home of evil, darkness, and sin," and put it on the refrigerator, you know, let alone over their front door, you know, in their entryway to their house, you know. Excuse me. And but that's what we think we are. And to the degree that we identify with our separate selves, our personas, stories, and the body serial adventures, the hero of the dream stuff, to the extent that I think I'm Bruce and you think you're Lynn, we're missing the point. And of course, it's silly to you know, and this is, it's not an impractical course. It doesn't suggest that, you know, when someone says, hey, Bruce, or hey, Lynn, or whoever, that we don't turn around and, you know, respond as a, you know, a typical human would, and do all the appropriate things in our lives that, you know, show, you know, reasonable stewardship of our bodies and our health regimen, and, you know, taking care of our responsibilities to our families and to our friends and to our jobs and our communities and our everything else that, you know, we're involved in. It has nothing to do with behavior, but it has everything to do with the mind. And that's where I think if we can reread the course, you know, over and over again consistently, pretty soon it starts to sink in. It's like, this has nothing to do with the form. It has everything to do with the mind. And that is so, it's such a peaceful idea. And that's, I think that's what, you know, why we're afraid of it, because we're invested. We put a lot of time and effort into this. I mean, we made a whole universe to hide from a mistaken identity. Because we think we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin, we have to undo that. We have to look at that belief, not all at once, but just in little pieces that, you know, everything, like Gary Renard's teachers say, you know, if whatever comes up in front of your face on any given day, moment to moment, that's your forgiveness classroom. That's the stuff to look at. So,
well, yeah, that's beautiful. And you know, you mentioning Gary, you know, there's a lot of people in our course community who don't have a lot of respect for Gary. And I think because they haven't really read and understood what he did, what these books have done or are doing for our awakening. Mm-hmm. You know, for whatever reasons, I think a lot of it is just jealousy, because it's very hard to think that, you know, some ascended master would come and talk to somebody like him. And so like it should have been me, which is what everybody's really thinking. And so if it wasn't me, then it really didn't happen, you know, those kind of things. But the way that those books are written and the way they communicate the principles of the course to people is so clear. And there's so many, I think there's probably millions of people who have come to the course because of those books.
And I personally can attest to that, as I actually am one of the retreads, I guess, is, I don't know, maybe that's not the best word, but I studied the course and I picked it up, you know, heard about it about a decade before, but I finally picked it up in the mid 80s and I studied it for a few years. And then I didn't abandon it completely, but I kind of set it aside for the most part until 2007, when there on a friend's coffee table that I was house sitting for was DU and Your Immortal Reality. And I picked up the first one and couldn't put it down. That was the week I was going to spend writing my second book. And it totally not only changed what I was put in the second book,
thank
but,
God.
but it totally recalibrated me. And, you know, like, you know, so many of Gary's readers say, you know, it became the can opener for opening up the course. And oh, it really about forgiveness. Oh my gosh, how did I miss that core practice that was at the heart of this curriculum? You know, and I'm sure I read those words, but the way that the easy, friendly language and the conversational tone of those books, you know, I can't recommend it highly enough. And again, you know, your mileage may vary, and some people may have a more scholarly approach and you know, find that there's, you know, another way of looking at it. But what Gary's books did for me was remind me how much was in there. And when I went back and looked at it with that awareness, the other thing that I think I somehow totally missed, and I think it was this resistance again, you know, the wanting to be a stumbler in the dark, metaphorically, was I think I wasn't ready until I picked those books up in 2007 to entertain the idea that, gee, just maybe the what we think of as the real, you know, the reality of God has nothing to do with duality, has nothing to do with the dream of space or time or individuality or separate interests, as it, you know, that's, I think the separate interest, and that's where I credit a lot of Ken's work, and in so many ways.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Ken Wapnick, because he comes at that idea that shared interests versus separate interests are a key theme, and a thing we can get our heads around, because, you know, perfect oneness, I think we all resonate to, but then we get to our everyday lives and say, okay, how do I apply this? Well, the way we apply it is by looking, like you were saying, Lynn, is just watching the stuff in our minds, our chatter and our negative talk and our internal critic, not only of ourselves, which, of course, it's really all about the self we've identified with that seems to be separate, but all the other seeming separate selves that we have these, you know, inner attacks on, whether it's just the most minor irritation or whether it's, you know, out and out warfare. It doesn't matter. The degree is not important, but anything that separates us, anything that makes us different or not the same is ego's fodder. But we can use those exact same thoughts by bringing them to mind, looking at them gently but firmly under the altar where the close encounters floodlight comes down from above the battleground, illuminating the silliness of those thoughts, and then we're no longer stumbling around in the dark. We're no longer, our cues for inference are no longer wrong, as chapter 21 says. We can then have that light to navigate. So should we read more of the lesson?
Yeah, go on.
I was trying to gently lead us back to that.
I noticed that. It's very, very interesting segue there. So, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, Oh, good. In order to see, you must recognize that light is within, not without. You do not see outside yourself, nor is the equipment for seeing outside you. And I'm just going to make a quick aside. When I was reading the word equipment, I was thinking, well, that's what we usually think of in terms of, okay, you know, a laptop if you're, you know, an IT person, or, you know, your box of craftsman's tools if you're a mechanic, you know, your drawer of scissors and thread, and if you're, you know, a seamstress or a seamster or whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. But the equipment that we're talking about, if this is all about the mind, has to be the thought system, that equipment. Anyway, so I'll start that over. In order to see, you must recognize that light is within, not without. You do not see outside yourself, nor is the equipment for seeing outside you. An essential part of this equipment is the light that makes seeing possible. It is with you always, making vision possible in every circumstance. Wow, isn't that cool? That means no matter where we're at, what we're doing, what part of the dream of space-time we think we're in, who we're with, who we're not with, what country, what city, state, province, neighborhood, home, you know, out in the wilderness, whatever, wherever we think we are that might be special in some way, whether it's special love or special hate, we have that choice for vision in every circumstance. It doesn't say, well, 99.98% of circumstances. It says every circumstance. That's kind of cool. That means that we have a universal curriculum here.
Yes. And what's really cool about all of this part is now there's a lot of teachers that are coming up, and I hear them like Rupert Spira, I could go Adi Shanti, all these teachers are coming up, and what they're saying is this very thing, very same thing in like another way, but it's the same thing, that everything that I'm seeing, everything that I experience is a projection from my own mind. Mm-hmm. And you can prove that because you can take the mind out of any circumstance and make it, I mean, you can make yourself believe that anything is happening. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, some guy could be coming to punch you in the face, and you can interpret that he's coming to give you a hug. Mm-hmm. You know, that, I mean, that and so you're seeing whatever it is that you is in your mind to see. And So every personality, Jesus tells us this, you make an ego for everyone and you make one for yourself. Every personality we see, every color we see, there's no way of even knowing if you and I think that trees look like the same thing. There's no way of knowing if you and I think blue is the same thing, because I'm the one who's making it up.
Yeah.
So you don't see outside of yourself. The equipment for seeing is inside of you. It's in your mind. People who are totally blind still see things in their mind. People who are totally deaf still hear things in their mind. Mm-hmm. It's all, every bit of it has nothing to do with the physical body. Right. So the essential part of the equipment is the light that makes seeing possible. And what is the light? God.
Exactly.
So God is with you always, and you can choose to see with that light. And when I choose to see with that light, then everything that I've ever, you know, every motive I think you have, everything I think that I see happening, it looks different. It actually looks different, because I am no longer looking for grievances and fault and anger, and I'm no longer looking for anything other than innocence. See, once I recognize I'm the one who made you guilty, then I can be the one who makes you innocent. Because
you did that, Lynn? So you're the one.
Yeah.
Oh man, now I've got a scapegoat. Goatscape is complete.
Well, you can thank me. but yeah, if once I figure out I'm the one who in my mind made you the guilty person, I can just change that. Because I made it up. That's the power of the mind, is so amazing. And it's not just, I mean, you think, well, yeah, but that's not practical. It is very practical.
It's very, very practical. In fact, what you were just touching on, and I think stated eloquently, is that, you know, that if we look at all the ways that we make other people guilty by trying to project that guilt, I think that's probably 90 plus, maybe 99 plus percent of the curriculum, is the way that, you know. And that was another thing that I was sharing of last night, when the three of us course students in cars getting Chinese takeout were gathered. And I was sharing one of my favorite little quips that Ken made on one of his audios. He's talking about how if we could really understand a newborn baby's, you know, babblings, what they would really be saying isn't goo goo gaga. It's not my fault.
Exactly.
You know, right out of the womb, you know, I was like, it's not my fault. I didn't ask for this, you know.
But did this to me?
Really, really, yeah. So you know, we come here with the victim script, and it takes countless forms, but it's all the same content in the mind that basically says, I think if I can convince myself that I'm this separate being, which is really a separate, you know, a separate crazy idea, fragmented off from perfect oneness, that then maybe I can foist this unconscious guilt that I don't want to look at on everything and everyone else, and just, you know, continue to blast that guilt away from me, you know, not in my mind's backyard, if you will, and get it away from me, you know, kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly.
Should we read some more?
Sure, I'll read this next one, because okay. Now, you know, Jesus is getting into, this is a lesson, and this is actually, I'm going to teach you how to do something really cool today. So he says, today, we are going to attempt to reach that light. For this purpose, we will use a form of exercise which has been suggested before and which we will utilize increasingly. It is a particularly difficult form for the undisciplined mind, and represents a major goal of mind training. It requires precisely what the untrained mind lacks. Yet this training must be accomplished if you are to see. Have at least 3 practice periods today, each lasting 3 to 5 minutes. A longer time is highly recommended, but only if you find the time slipping by with little or no sense of strain. And if you are doing that, slipping by with no doses of strain, you're doing good. The form of practice we will use today is the most natural and easy one in the world for the trained mind, just as it seems to be the most unnatural and difficult for the untrained mind. I'm just going to read on a little bit.
Sure.
So now he's so sweet. Lesson 44, he's telling us, your mind is no longer wholly untrained. You are quite ready to learn the form of exercise we will use today, but you may find that while you will encounter strong resistance. Like to say in those words. The reason is very simple. While you practice in this way, you leave behind everything that you now believe and all the thoughts that you have made up. Properly speaking, this is the release from hell. Wow. Yet perceived through the ego's eyes, it is a loss of identity and a descent into hell. And I'm just going to stop there and see if you have anything to say about it.
Oh, I just think that's so you know, incisively, you know, profound, because it basically is at the heart of the whole non-duality of the Course and how we've inverted everything. We've got, and it is a course in not know, and that's I think where, you know, we it's so easy to get off track. But yet the Course's gentle reminders by showing us the cognitive dissonance in our minds of the ego's insanity. And, you know, he says, your mind is no longer wholly untrained. Well, I mean, it's equivalent to saying your mind is no longer wholly insane, and which is stated elsewhere in the Course, and basically those words. And what it's suggesting is we've seen enough now. We've convinced ourselves that the way that we've chosen as individuals hasn't worked, is not going to work, and we might as well give up on it. But we don't have to do it all at once. We get as many years or lifetimes as we want. You know, knock yourself out if you want to. You know, try every single alternative but forgiveness. You know, if you think that's going to work, then go for it. But I think it pokes fun at that in the most kind-hearted way by saying, you know, you can actually look at your thoughts and not condemn yourself. It's possible to do those two things together, just to reveal in your mind the dysfunctional thought system of the ego and to release it. And that's the first two steps of the forgiveness process. And then what's behind that will automatically replace. That's why the Course says, you know, we don't do the third step ourselves, and we just have to get the heck out of the way, because the replacement is really the yes that's behind the not no, the eternal yes that is the immortal self that we all share, that is the perfect oneness that we never left. But because we're so invested and we still think that we're going to get a little bit of mileage left out of this seemingly separate self, and that somehow it's going to do it for us. That, you know, we have the right amorous relationship, or the right car, or the right living situation, the right home. If we move to the right part of the country or the planet, if we learn the right amount of stuff and practice the right amount of spiritual disciplines and all the anything that has to do with form, you know, if we think that somehow that's going to do it for us. You know, we're basically playing back into ego's hand again and doing it with ego's rules, and we know it's not going to work. Just like, you know, Lucy's going to keep pulling away Charlie Brown's football at the last second and whump down on the ground, you know. but we have to do that enough times where we realize, you know, when Jesus asks, you know, metaphorically, how's that working out for you? You know, and it's not a mean-spirited question. It's just a gentle, persistent, like lesson 182 says, you know, it's this little child that says, you know, when can we go home? Let's go home together. Let's take my hand and let's stop this pointless, wearying practice of condemning everything and everyone, which only serves to condemn our seeming identity. And but that has had no effect. It didn't change reality. You know, not one note in heaven's song was missed, and we can go home, and we can return to that perfect oneness But we don't do it all at once. We just do it a little by little. We let go of our ego investment by forgiving ourselves for indulging in ego, and seeing that it had no effect on what we are in truth, and that the real identity, as this paragraph you just read suggests, you know, is a heaven, because it's free of that self-condemnation. It's free of any incriminating idea that suggests that we've messed things up. It wasn't possible. But that also means that the self that we're so heavily invested in also is impossible. And that's where the terror lies, because we think we have to give up and sacrifice something. But what the Course is saying, well, look at it from a, you know, turn it around and see it a different way, that maybe the self that we made up is the sacrifice. What if that is the real descent into hell, but that hell isn't real and the descent never happened?
Well, and you know what's so crazy about that, Bruce, is that it is our entire, well, I can't speak for you, but I bet I can. our entire mode of operation in this world is based on sacrifice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, everything is, you know, I have to sacrifice my air so that you can breathe.
Right.
I have to sacrifice my clean water so that you can have water. I have to sacrifice my time so that, you know, I can, you know, be a good mother. You know, I had to give up my career so that I could, you know, stay at home and take care of a sick child. You know, I didn't have an egg this morning for breakfast because I wanted my, you know, husband to have two eggs. You know, I mean, it's silly. If I want to buy cheap clothes at Walmart, somebody in China has to work like slave labor wages. Or, I mean, that's just generalization.
So it's best that we stop even being a breatharian because we're killing bacteria, and go around naked because, you know, we're basically, you know, destroying the environment. So obviously, you know, it'd be silly to take that to the extreme. You know, it really gets back to, well, what's going through our mind? What is the motive? Can we look at that desolation without condemnation?
Yes.
And see that nothing happened. And, you know, be as kind as we can in the world, but that we're never going to achieve that, because it was set up as a, you know, it's all propaganda for itself. It's all set up as a foolproof but not God-proof system to keep us mindless and enthralled with ego's thought system. But we have an alternative. We can choose, you know, there is a better way, and we can choose it. And that better way is the not know, the gentle not know of the Holy Spirit's curriculum, that just looks at everything that's going on, that looks at every little hellish scrap and of fear that ego's hungry dogs go after, and just say, you know, drop it.
Yes. And that's what he says. The next paragraph starts, if you can stand aside from the ego by ever so little, you will have no difficulty in recognizing that its opposition and its fears are meaningless. See, that's it. If you can just step aside and look at what it is with the light, not through the ego's interpretation, because you're going to continue. And this happens to me over and over and over. I choose to see things differently. I start seeing exceptions, but what about this and what about that? And, you know, it is something that has to be consistent and constant. It's not something that you can just do once in a while. And it's something that you really have to be, committed to, because it does have results. In other places he said, you know, if you weren't getting so much help in this direction, if you were, I mean, there are forces that are leaning toward you, helping you and giving you the energy and the help that you need to be able to do this. You can call on them to help you too, mm-hmm. when you're having trouble. And we do that, you know, that's, so he says, you know, just stand aside from the ego just a little bit. And you might find it helpful to remind yourself from time to time that to reach light is to escape from darkness, whatever you may believe to the contrary. Right. You know, you're arguing with yourself here. And God is the light in which you see. You are attempting to reach him. And just reminding yourself, and you know, don't get lost in the argument. Just recognize, you know, it's like a child, you know, wanting a knife. You know, you just got to say no. And no matter how much he cries and says please, you just don't give it to him. That's what it is when you yeah. when it's the same thing.
It's sort of like we have this infinitely benevolent inner peace officer who says, step away from that thought system and no one will get hurt. You know, because that's it. I mean, we you know, if we can just say, you know, don't touch it. Don't, you know, step away just gently, you know, don't watch your wanting to grasp onto that identity that says that differences are important and that I have a right to my, damn it, I have a right to my victimhood, you know, and I'm going to fight for it. And just watch those thoughts and see how frantic and frenetic and futile they are. And just, you know, forgiveness is a better alternative, you know, but we don't learn that until we practice it enough. And it does take a long time. And what you were talking about a moment ago reminded me in the Manual for Teachers, the Development of Trust, the fifth stage has a paragraph that starts out kind of discouraging, like, you know, this could take a really long time. And, you know, but it's not meant to discourage us, but to encourage us to be patient. And I think the most encouraging part for me of that paragraph is it says something to the effect of, if each step were not so heavily reinforced, it would be hard indeed.
Yep.
And but there's the perfect antidote, the perfect no, the perfect not to ego's no, is the reinforcement that the gentle metaphoric holding of our hand that the Holy Spirit, our inner peace officer, provides us, that says, you know, look at that, step away from that vehicle that you've wrapped your identity in. That actor on the screen and step away from that identification. No, you're still going to see yourself as a body, but if you can shift your identity back from the actor on the screen or on the stage to the playwright in the audience, then it's like it's such a relief. And those moments of respite that lesson 182 talks about is that, oh, what a relief that we have when we give ourselves those moments of release. And that's, I think, what this lesson is suggesting that we do, that we just step away, even if it's just for a moment, when we see that God is the light in which we see, that that spirit, that oneness that we all share, that it takes the form, seemingly, of sameness in our minds. That light that sees that our brother, and metaphorically, is the same as the self that we think we are, that dissolution of differences and restoration of sameness is the mechanism, that's the equipment, that's the vehicle that gets us where we do want to be. And we can all hop aboard that train together, and we all do it together each time we choose that. We're all joined as one because minds are joined.
So. Yes, yes, yes. And that is such a great thing to know also, if you're kind of like me, and I know you are, that you really want to help the world and you really want to save the world. And Jesus asks us over and over, do you want to help me save the world? And so, you know, how do we do that? And, you know, Carrie was mentioning on here about saving the whales and protect the coral reefs and stop the artificial intelligence, we're going to destroy God's earth, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's the kind of things that you think, or I'm going to destroy my child's life if I don't get them braces, or I'm going to live destitute when I'm old if I don't have a pension plan, and things that we think and are so pervasive in our minds that are completely foundless. They have no foundation whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's all speculation on our part. And that speculation actually ends up being our experience because we're projecting it. And so as long as you're projecting that experience, guess what experience you're going to have? You're not going to have a different experience.
Yeah, yeah.
But as much as you'd like to try.
Yeah, really. Stands to reason, doesn't it?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know what, Bruce, our time is up.
I've noticed that. Well, and I'd like to just quick remind people that if you haven't already, check out weekendoffreedom.org or .com. It's actually a retreat. It's being called a retreat in Estes Park in June, Colorado, in June 16th through the 19th. I think it's going to be a blast. I just posted another interview with Barrett Hedin on that website, as well as on ACIMblog.com. So I've got everybody recorded in little quick video conversations that have been a lot of fun to do. And the last one I'll be doing in about a week and a half from now is with Gary Renard and Cindy Laura Renard, who are also going to be there. Along with all the other folks, which I think is going to be a blast. So anyway, without taking up any more time, just encourage you, if you have the least inclination to be part of a 4-day retreat in Estes Park, Colorado in June, I think it's going to be great fun. It's at weekendoffreedomretreat.org or .com. So anyway, thanks, Lynn. I always enjoy our conversations, and it's such good reminders for me. So that's why I enjoy doing it. And I imagine for you too. So have a great week in the forgiveness classroom, everyone.
Excellent. Yeah. And you know what? To me, it's the joining. And that's what I see the power of all of this, yes, is in that you and I came together for a purpose, and that joining brings about something more powerful than I could ever experience in my own mind, because we're doing it together.
Yeah. And, the conversation really is more than the sum of the parts, isn't it?
It is, absolutely, yeah, always. Yeah. So thank you so much, Bruce, and thank you everyone who joined
thank
in.
You.
And there's a lot of people on the board that have been listening and commenting and whatever, but I do appreciate that very much.
Yes.
So, all righty, we'll talk to you next week, Bruce. And, oh, hey,
likewise.
I might give you a call later. I'm trying to put a different kind of calendar on our website, but
okay.
I'm not sure how it's, maybe you might be able to help me. I'm not sure.
Sure.
But anyway, I will talk to you later. I love
okay.
you, Bruce.
Okay. Likewise. Have a great week, everyone.
All right. Love you. Bye-bye.